607 Power Integrations v. Semiconductor Components. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I just ask you, before you get into your argument,
yes,
I just wanted to know what the status is of this corresponding district court litigation going
yes.
on in this case. And I know there was a remand on
yes.
damages. Is there anything going on in that case that we ought to know about?
We were just in front of Judge Chesney, actually, last week. And so she recognizes the case has been remanded to her, she was unaware this case is being argued today, and basically we agreed to report back. So she hasn't yet scheduled the case for further
okay.
proceedings.
Is it officially stayed, or she's just...
Okay. It's not officially stayed, and in fact, what we agreed to do was to get back to her with a status after this argument and or the opinion in this case, depending on how long it takes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
We can proceed now.
Okay. I'd like to spend start with and spend most of my time on the Section 315B issue because I think it cuts across. It potentially obviates the other issue in this appeal and actually affects a large number of other appeals on this court's docket. And on that, I'd like to start with what the legal framework is.
But we haven't decided this issue, right? The issue of the 315B issue about the filing versus the institution.
You have not.
Are you aware of cases that have actually been argued that are pending decision in our court that have present that issue? Or are you just talking about all these other IPRs that you all have?
No, when I say legal, so two questions there. I'm not aware of a pending case that has that specific issue. When I say legal framework, I'm referring to the court's two recent opinions, Applications and Internet Time. I believe Judge Reyna sat on that panel, and the World's case, which Your Honor sat on, which addressed the 315B framework. How do we approach the assessing what privity and real party and interest is? What evidence do you look at? What are the burdens and so forth? But
this is a different issue. This is really construing these words.
It is. It is a statutory construction issue. There's at least three really important stakes really to put in the ground here. Number one, as both those cases, Applications in Internet Time and Worlds emphasize, the burden is on the petitioner to show that it has standing. The burden is not on the patent owner to show that there's a privity problem. And in this case, clearly the board reversed that burden. And if you go look at the two board cases that this board cites to, the Aris case...
We can go one of two ways in this case, which I think you're suggesting. Either we can agree with you on the statutory construction point, end of story, well, leaving aside all these other issues of
yes.
preclusion, or we say at a minimum there was enough to require discovery here in terms of the facts that were raised. So is that your point?
Correct, and there's actually a third thing, right? So if we're right on statutory construction, everyone agrees we win, this IPR is barred.
Except for the preclusion issues, right? Like whether you were precluded.
Okay, yes, we could talk about that separately, yes. Then the second point is, yes, at a minimum, and we made this argument below, we at least... made a showing that we should have been entitled to discover. I mean, to say on this record that we were merely speculating that Ahn was behaving on behalf of a Fairchild is fairly remarkable, and I can go through that evidence.
Even if it's as of the filing.
I mean, you know, look at what we had as of that date. We had a confidentiality agreement between the parties that acknowledged a common legal and commercial interest. We had a definitive merger agreement between the parties. We have...
No, I understand.
Okay, okay, all that.
So go back to statutory.
Wait, did you have a third option? I thought I heard you say a third option.
The third option is, even if you look only at the time of the filing of the petition, right, the evidence as of that time, we think, shows is sufficient to show privity or proxy relationship.
So you're saying you don't even need discovery. You think right now there's sufficient...
I do. In view of this court's cases and in view of the sort of the backdrop here, I think we should win. Okay, so let me get back. So it's petitioners.
Let's get back to the evidence. You refer to the agreement.
Yes. But
basically, that was an agreement to agree sometime in the future. That was not a fully executed contractual agreement.
Well, not entirely sure. I mean, both of the agreements were certainly fully executed. The merger hadn't happened yet. If you're talking about
the merger agreement.
That's true. But in a way, it's hard to see why the formal closing of the merger should be a sine qua non, right? We can all agree, and in fact, we agree in this case, once it closed.
Well, it's because at some point, if they do close, then you're going to argue, look, they closed on this merger, they're merged, and therefore that's dispositive.
Right. So,
well, if they haven't merged, why don't we look at it the other way?
Well, I think you have to look at it both ways, Your Honor, is my point. So once it's closed, that's a bookend, okay? Once the merger closes, there's no question we have a real party in interest, a privity, a proxy relationship, game over, okay? The question is, if you look earlier in time, once the agreement to merge is entered, and we have all these other facts as well, are the parties behaving even then, one as a proxy for the other? And just as a practical matter and a common sense matter, the answer, I think, is of course they are. You know, the merger is entered on the assumption these regulatory approvals are going to happen. You wouldn't enter a 136-page definitive merger agreement if you didn't think you were going to get Chinese regulatory approval or U.S. regulatory approval. And so, in the meantime, how are the parties behaving? They're behaving as though that's going to happen. And on, in this case, clearly is acting on behalf of Fairchild to set aside and to wipe out this particular IPR and 11 others. I mean,
can we move back to the statutory? Because
yes.
I think you've responded to Joe.
Okay. Okay.
But on the statute, you've got two potential options here: statute unambiguous, you win.
Right.
Or statute ambiguous, but we can't defer to the PTAB here because you would lose under that kind of deference to the non-precedential board decisions here. So where do we go if it's ambiguous?
Well, two things on that. First of all, even ON argues it's not ambiguous, so both parties are in front of you saying
it's clear. Yeah, but we get to
clear.
Decide that no matter
of course, what you of course.
And also they have very different views about
it. That's true.
which might suggest ambiguity.
We wouldn't be here, otherwise, would we? But there's still no deference, even if you look at the PTAB's interpretation. Because number one, their regulation in relevant part just parrots the statute.
So we accept that. Okay. So position is there's no deference to the regulation,
right,
and there's no deference to the PTAB.
Right, and there's no deference
because
for two reasons. Number one, it's merely a parroting regulation, and the court in Aqua Products specifically addressed that and said, look, if the regulation at issue is merely repeating what the statute says, you don't get deference for that.
What about the non-precedential decisions? Didn't they analyze the
statute? I'm sorry. The board's
non-precedential decisions,
yes,
that interpret the statute, would they get any sort of our deference?
No, because an interpretation of a regulation that itself is simply parrots this. I mean, it's just one step removed. It doesn't get any.
What if the PTAB in these non-precedential decisions analyze the statute? Forget the reg. They're looking at the statute. They've got to decide. They say statute means time of filing. That's the operative time frame. Do we have to defer to that?
Absolutely not.
Because
this court doesn't defer to an agency's determination of its own authority, its own statutory authority. That's Wi-Fi 1. That was the key takeaway from the Wi-Fi 1 case. You can't, it's sort of the fox guarding the hen house, right? You can't have an agency telling you what their statutory jurisdiction is and then coming in front of you and saying, you have to defer to me on what I'm telling you my statutory jurisdiction is.
And the case there
is? It's Wi-Fi 1.
No, but hasn't the Supreme Court spoken on virtually every aspect of this deference question? You don't know the, okay.
Well, they've spoken most clearly, the SAS case most clearly dealt with the issue of where the statute is clear and unambiguous. There's no deference.
Okay. Can we go back? So let's go back to figuring out whether it's ambiguous or unambiguous.
Okay.
But you say, I'm sorry, at the end of the day, you say there's nothing to defer to here.
Correct.
So we've got an ambiguous question, and therefore it's up to the court to decide the best reading of the statute.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why is this, assuming we're there,
yes.
Why is this necessarily the best reading? For example, we all know what the filing date is. This institution date is kind of fluid. I mean, where is the policy if we're going to play policy today? What is the policy? And we don't know when they're going to institute. So if the merger is complete on Monday, they could institute on Tuesday. They could have instituted on the previous Friday. That seems kind of an arbitrary thing, therefore, on which to hinge this.
You look at both is the answer. Right. I mean, so I think the real issue here is why should the board, acting in a quasi-judicial capacity, put the blinders on and look only at one point in time and consider nothing else that has happened up to the point of their decision? And the policy answer to that is very clearly in our favor, because the legislative history is very clear. Congress intended to prevent serial attacks on patents. That's what's going on here. This is attack number 4 on this patent. And ON actually agrees the legislative history, quote, describes a policy in favor of preclusion. So we all agree what Congress is trying to do here. And what the board is doing with its interpretation is frustrating that policy.
I was just going to ask you, you said you look at both the time of filing and the time of institution.
Yes.
But I think what you might actually be saying is you look and you test through the entire institution stage and see if that condition in 315B is met at any point prior to institution.
That is exactly correct. And in fact, that is what, again, the Wi-Fi 1 court en banc said, timeliness may be decided fully and finally at the institution stage. Okay? So the court, I think, has already answered this question.
Not really, because we weren't considering this exact question in front of us.
Okay, but I would say it's at least consistent with that observation in Wi-Fi 1. And I guess what I'm saying, let me go back to the bookend thing, okay? Back to Judge Reyna's question. I mean, if the question can be answered definitively at institution, it should be. If it can be answered definitively at filing, I mean, we think this is such a case. There may be other cases where, look, you can look just at filing, and you can look at filing and say they were in privity at filing. Fine.
What about after that? I mean, one of the things you rely on is this regulation for the board that says that you got to tell the PTAB, notify the PTAB if there's a change in status. That doesn't end at institution. That's an ongoing requirement, right? So why, under your theory of what we're trying to accomplish here, what if the merger went through? Let's forget your other argument.
Yes.
What was going on was enough. But let's assume it wasn't, and the merger goes through a week after institution. The regulations say somebody's supposed to notify the PTAB of that. But even under your reading of the statute, that isn't going to destroy this. That's not going to be a problem.
That's true. And the answer lies in the text of the statute. The statute says, not the regulation, which is different in this respect. The statute says review may not be instituted. Instituted, okay? It doesn't say that once you've instituted, if you've instituted at a time when there's no bar, it doesn't say, well, later if a bar arises, then we have to dismiss. So that's a red herring with all due respect. I know ON makes that argument, but read the statute. The statute is very clear, and it at least counts under the statute what the state of the world is at institution.
So you're just one thing that I was thinking is that it is potentially a limit on the PTO's power to institute. But you're right. It doesn't say it may not proceed or it's barred. What do you make of the fact that, and I don't know even know if this even matters, but 315A1 says inter-parties review barred by civil action. That's different language. You don't have that same introductory language here. It just says patent owner's action. Do you think it makes a difference? Is there supposed to be some difference in how 315A1 is read, where it says it's barred by civil action? The next sentence says an inter partes review may not be instituted. But before that, it talks about barring.
The language is different. I'm not sure the substantive outcome is different, because 315B says what the barring event is that the party or the privity was served with a complaint more than 1 year prior. So ultimately, they both relate to what happened in a prior civil action. I confess I haven't put them side by side and thought super carefully about whether there's some nuance that matters here. I don't think there's anything in the text of 315A that changes the outcome under 315B based on our arguments.
Can we move on then to the sort of sub-issue
Yes.
part of this, which is leaving waiver aside. So let's assume they didn't waive their argument.
Okay.
What about the preclusion issue that's been raised in the papers here?
Right. So that is...
The other IPRs hanging out there.
Right.
And one of which, at least one of which, you didn't appeal the identical 315B ruling. By
right. So fundamentally, there's sort of two responses to that. One is that this is an argument they could have put in their main brief and didn't.
No.
So, you
want to
put that to one side. Okay.
I understand your argument about that.
Okay.
And we'll evaluate it, obviously, but leave that aside.
Okay. So issue preclusion is inequitable. It's an equitable court created doctrine, and there are well recognized exceptions to issue preclusion.
So what's okay? your exception?
It's the inadequate incentive to litigate this issue to the end in every single IPR where it has arisen, and in particular, so there are eight. Count them. Eight pending appeals in front of this court that hinge on this privity determination. And they have found one in which we did not choose to appeal because that there were multiple IPRs on that patent. That's the 457 patent. And the particular claims in that particular IPR on that patent were really not strategically, let me put it that way, important.
I understand your argument. I'm just wondering, we're here at the appellate level.
Yes.
And your argument suggests that we as an appellate court then have to do kind of a fact-based weighing of the equities here. I mean, if you're saying determining whether or not there was an incentive, that's a kind of difficult question to answer at the appellate level, is it not?
Well, I do think ultimately, I won't deny it may, you have to look at the facts, I think, to exercise your discretion. But this court ultimately makes the call on whether there's preclusion or not. That's a legal issue. And in fact, the court has done it in other cases and indeed addressed that issue and indeed has done it in the cases on sites, this BMB hardware case, the Max Linear case. And those cases are actually pretty instructive because, Max Linear in particular, which they think is their best case, there was preclusion there because in the prior IPR, another panel of this court had affirmed that the two claims at issue were invalid. So there had been judicial review by this court of the issue. Here, they want to apply issue preclusion, which is, again, an equitable doctrine, to prevent you from addressing the issue, ever, right? So if you go with them on issue preclusion, they're saying, you can't address it in this IPR, and you're going to have the same argument in the other seven IPRs. You can't ever address this issue. So,
and then moving finally on to the waiver piece of this. So, I mean, they filed their brief was ready to go. I assume it was at the printers by the time they realized this issue. Why are they precluded from them coming back to the court at some subsequent time before we reach our decision and bringing this to our attention?
Well, I guess, again, that ultimately is a discretionary call, and it's up to the court, right? And I guess I would say it's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If on the one hand they want a mulligan on that, and they were 1 day later, 2 days later, whatever, okay, fine. But then why should we be held to a particularly strict application of issue preclusion where there is a recognized exception to its application where you didn't have an incentive to pursue every issue in every appeal to the end, and where the result of it would be, again, depriving this court of the ability to ever review the issue?
Well, what if this had come out the day after they filed their brief? Where would you be on the waiver? Would you say, I mean, they filed something subsequently, more recently.
Right.
So what if it had come out the day after they filed their red brief? What, in your view, would they have had to do in order to avoid waiver?
Well, I think there probably wouldn't be a waiver argument then.
Sorry.
I think we would not have a waiver argument in that scenario, but candidly, right? I mean, it's the point is they could have raised it. They didn't. And it's ultimately a super technical argument, right? Which is the argument they're trying to ring us up on. So I guess we're just pointing out the flip side of the coin. And there's all sorts of reasons why this court should reach the issue. I know I'm well over here. So
okay. Thank further? You, Will. We'll reserve some rebuttal for you.
Thank you.
Just to accord the same courtesy to you, did you have anything to add to Mr. Shirkamok's update to us on what was going on in the district court?
No, Your Honor, we agree. The district court hasn't formally stayed, but is looking to see what happens.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Representing Semiconductor Components Industries, or SCI, which was a company that, based on its interest in its own products, brought this IPR in order to keep the public in possession of technology that is disclosed and suggested in the prior art. But I certainly understand that the panel seems particularly interested in the 315B issues. So I'll start there and happy to entertain your questions. I think obviously the key point that the panel raises is let's look at the statutory text. And I'll note that my colleague in presenting the statutory text actually stops before the word if. If you look at 315B, 315B is divided and says, you know, that you're not going to institute if, and then gives the condition. And the question is before the court is, what is the date you look at in assessing that condition? So it's rather strange to make a statutory argument and ignore that actual text, the text of the condition for the bar. And if you look at the text of the condition for the bar, you'll see, as the board pointed out in its decision, that the only date referred to in the condition is the file date, is filed. That's the date pointed out in the language that actually goes to the condition.
What about the may not be instituted language that arguably limits the PTO's power to institute? The PTO, an inter-parties review, may not be instituted if... And then what if that condition is, why would the PTO be able to say, well, we can institute now because this condition was met at the time of filing? It seems to me that that's a limit on their power.
Well, first of all, I agree that it's a limit on the PTO, but what it's a limit based on is something that is the case at filing it. The limit is conditioned on whether something is filed in a particular condition.
But that condition is met after the fact when a new real party of interest actually had a case filed against it more than a year before the filing of the petition, right?
No, Your Honor, because the condition is specific to is filed. That's how the condition is set forth in the statute.
It doesn't say you test this at the time of filing. You agree with that, right?
The language is not that specific, Your Honor. I certainly agree. But I think if you look at the condition language, the only date referred to is the filing date. It's when the petition is filed. Those are the words of the statute. So that's the only date referred to in the condition.
Just a simple example. If the statute said you may not institute if the party that filed was under 18 at the time of filing. They're clearly looking at the time of filing, even though it has to do with an institution decision. Is that sort of apt?
I think that would be fair. That's the Congress could have put more language in there, but they did put a date in the condition, and the date is the filing date.
But
yes, Your Honor.
The court, in looking at 315B, said that the director is without authority to, we say institute, but it's really to entertain the proceeding if 315B is not met. It seems to me that your argument kind of goes back against our decision in Y51. It's contrary to Y51. If the 315B rests on whether or not the director actually had authority to conduct the proceeding, then why would it have the authority after the filing date? Why would we, under those conditions, say the filing date, after the filing date, the director always has authority?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, Wi-Fi 1 refers to this as the timeliness of the petition. That's how Wi-Fi 1 refers to the 315B test. So in its actual wording, it's talking about, was the petition timely? So that, again, refers to that filing date of the petition. Not is the petition subsequently, even though timely, when filed, subsequently somehow just debarred or found to be problematic. Wi-Fi 1, in focusing, and I agree with you, Your Honor, in focusing on the power of the Patent Office for IPRs, focuses on the timeliness of the petition. So again, the condition they're looking at is the condition at the time that petition was filed. That's why the petition is either timely or not timely.
Why does that make any more sense than institution?
Well, Your Honor, I think you actually raised there's this policy issue, right, that if institution's a moving target, and I direct, Your Honor asked for Supreme Court guidance on this, and I would direct the court to the Grupo Dataflux case, which is 541 U.S. 567, and the discussion of this point is at 580. And in that case, the Supreme Court specifically talked about how a time of filing rule is useful because the facts are subject to change. Obviously, this case illustrates the fact that the facts are subject to change. And the Supreme Court said, and because constant litigation in response to that change would be wasteful. So the Supreme Court was pointing out that the reason you have a time of filing rule is so that you can look at all the facts and figure it out, as opposed to, for example, having an institution decision and realizing, well, we made the institution decision, but the facts changed the night before, or the facts changed even on the day of. The Supreme Court has realized there are policy reasons why having a time of filing analysis is superior.
That doesn't make much sense to me, where we're supposed to be looking at what Congress intended, right? So we shouldn't look necessarily to a Supreme Court case to determine what the proper policy is. Shouldn't we just be looking at what we think we best understand Congress to have expressed by the plain language of this statute?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the Supreme Court, in discussing why time of filing is, in a policy matter, superior, is relevant. But I agree that we should also look at what has Congress been doing? How do we analyze where Congress is sitting? And I point, Your Honor, to the fact that the Interparties Re-Exam, so the predecessor to the IPR, that used a different analysis. That actually used something much more like issue preclusion, where you looked at the end of the case, not the filing, but the end of the case, to do the analysis. Congress clearly was changing its approach by going from the end of the district court case, which is what it looked at in the Interparties Re-Exam situation in its previous statute, to looking at the filing of the IPR petition, which is what is in the language of the current statute. So, Your Honor, I would say that if we're focusing on Congress and saying, what happened here? I think what happened here is Congress changed what it was doing between the re-exam and the IPR.
I want to ask you, Chief Judge Prost's question about Supreme Court case law. Her question actually went to our deference and whether we should be giving our deference to non-precedential opinions of the board interpreting this statutory provision. Do you have an answer to that question?
Your Honor, our position is that those are persuasive, but that we don't believe that they're deferential. However, I disagree with my colleague in terms of the regulation that he says just parrots. If you actually look at the regulation, which is Rule 42.101, you'll see that the regulation specifically uses the language about may file. So that the regulation goes beyond, and it actually kind of goes to the language you were suggesting, Your Honor, that Congress could have used, which is to focus on that filing date even before you get to the condition. And that language is that the person who is not an owner of the patent may file with the office a petition unless the petition requesting the proceeding is filed
But that's still mushy. I mean, if we get to that point, it's because we've decided that the statutory language is ambiguous, and that hardly gives us, I think, a clear-cut roadmap to answering the question. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't. Can I ask you, even assuming there's the 315B is otherwise, and what your friend said was, well, even if you're right on the statutory construction, at a minimum, the board should have given them discovery and probably even likely concluded based on the record that there was a problem here. It seems to me, I'm a little troubled because it seems like the only thing the board said, they said something which I find kind of confusing, where they said because ON was not Fairchild's proxy because it had its own interest. And what it called its own interest is what the board articulated was it had a multi-billion dollar merger pending at the time of filing of this petition.
Your Honor,
that seems backwards, where that reason is entirely derivative of this thing that we're adjudicating. Do you understand my problem? Why I think
I understand, Your Honor, and I think
on that.
Your Honor, I think you have to look at that in the context of their description of that merger agreement, right? So at pages A11 and A13, and this is the board's opinion, the board is giving the evidence and the factual background for its conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So the board is talking specifically about the conditions in this merger agreement. So the board refers specifically to, and it's in your record, I know the board uses other citation numbers, but it's in your record at page 1826 in the third, I believe it's the third volume, Your Honor. But specifically what the board is looking at is these were parties in the same industry, and that's, so we have all these antitrust issues. And the board looks and says, look, this agreement identified that these were parties in the same industry with antitrust issues as a result. This merger agreement talks specifically about all the ways in which they might not get approval. And in fact, the merger agreement sets forth these different timeframes for if we don't get approval, this is what happens. If we don't get approval, this is what happens. That's in the merger agreement that they looked at. Going to your question, Your Honor, that was what they found showed that ON had its own interest. ON was in this industry with the same types of products, and we've got a litigious patentee asserting patents against these types of products. And the board says, look at what we did in, we looked at the merger agreement, this multi-billion dollar merger, and it shows that ON had its own interest. And of course, here on appeal, once they said, well, ON had no interest, you know, we showed the court years before any of this, they were accusing ON's products.
Yeah, but they
There's
said
no question.
They had an interest because they had a merger pending, which suggests to me that they had an interest because they knew they might become part of this other entity, and this other entity was being sued. That all seems part and parcel of what really is makes them a not a real party of interest. You understand? I mean, it's all derivative from the fact that they had a merger pending. I think the other side would agree. That's why they were one and the same, because at least there was a 50% chance that they were going to be merged into this other entity, which was being sued on multiple patents in district court. So it seems to me the pending merger is what creates this privity problem.
Your Honor, their argument certainly is that the pending merger is what creates the privity problem. No question. The board looked at that specifically and said, well, you know, you might be able to backdate under Taylor factor number 4. You might be able to backdate from the formal merger. The board did not say, oh, we're going to wait till the formal merger. They looked at the conditions.
Right.
But they said this IPR petition was well before that. So this is on page A13 where the board talks about the conditions. Going to your question, Your Honor, the point the board was making was ON had its own interest, but in view of that merger agreement, ON needed to file because what was going to happen was there was going to be a technicality here where ON, with its own products and with an accusation against it, was going to lose its right that Congress had given it to file an IPR. That's why the merger agreement showed that ON had to file this IPR, because otherwise they were going to lose their right.
When the board reviewed the merger agreement and then entered its analysis, it only did that on the basis of control, correct?
No, Your Honor. They talked, well, first of all, there are two types of control under Taylor. So I agree with you that they looked at it from control with regard to controlling the initial litigation and control the IPR, because Taylor has two categories. I believe they're categories 4 and 5.
And our case law already establishes that control is not the single factor.
That's right. And the board addressed that. They say specifically that control
is not. Well, it seems here that the board said there's many factors involved here, and control is one of them. And then it goes off and just focuses on control and nothing else.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. I think they looked at the three Taylor factors that are important in this case. The first is, according to Taylor, and this is factor number 2 in Taylor, the substantive legal relationship. And that's not one of the control factors in Taylor. And that's where the board looked at the merger agreement, looked at the conditions.
But the legal relationship is a factor of control.
Well, Your Honor,
one of the ways to establish control is by showing the legal relationship of parties.
Well, Your Honor, in Taylor, the Supreme Court actually treats that one as a separate category. If it's, this is on, Your Honor, on in Taylor and the specific categories Taylor has for privity. And this would be in Taylor, and the page in Taylor v. Sturgill is 894, Your Honor. So the Supreme Court says there's substantive legal relationship, there's control of the prior litigation by the new litigant, and then there's control of the new litigation by the prior litigant. Those are the three categories that are in play here. And the board made affirmative findings on all three. On the first category, the board made the affirmative finding that in view of what had happened in the merger with the conditions, and this is that analysis on page A11.
But where in the board decision did they focus on that second item, the second factor you just brought up?
It would be on page A11, Your Honor, where they looked at the potential for a substantive legal relationship, in the words of Taylor. They looked at whether the merger agreement, despite not being formally finished, had, despite that, created a substantive legal relationship. And they said, well, based on the evidence, you could get back a certain amount, but that ON has shown you can't get back before that, and that the IPR petition was well before that, like 5 months before that. The second factor they looked at, and they talk about as being proxy, is the Taylor v. Sturgill factor number 4, which is, did SCI have control over the previous litigation? But here there's no dispute that the invalidity arguments in that previous litigation, the one in California that we just finished talking about, had gone to trial long before even there was a merger agreement or a confidentiality agreement.
Can I have a question for you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I remember correctly that the board issued its decision well before some of our more recent decisions fleshing out privity, for example, the Western Gecko case?
I mean, certainly, Your Honor, the board issued the decision, I believe, in late 2017. So any cases after that, certainly not. But, I mean, the Western GECO board also issued its decision years before the Western GECO decision and still was affirmed with respect to its treatment. So I would also say
some of our more recent cases talking about how control is not the number one factor and shouldn't be the...
Your Honor, I would ask you, the final written decision specifically says that control is not the only factor. It specifically talks about Taylor v. Sturgill and lists the categories. It cites to the page in Taylor v. Sturgill where those categories are listed. This board knew that that was not the only factor and specifically cited to Taylor, which is what this court has looked to, for the number of categories that can apply to privity.
Can I just ask you, your time is up, but let me just ask you to speak briefly on the question of preclusion. And why is your friend not right that we would, to do otherwise, we would be telling parties that they're being forced to file appeals on matters they no longer care about? So, it seems odd that we would be compelling people to file all of these useless appeals simply to preserve this one issue, which is now before us.
So the first thing I'd say, Your Honor, is there is no evidence that this is an unimportant issue. It's mere attorney argument, and we pointed out in our reply all the other statements they've made that these claims are important. So first of all, keep in mind it's only attorney argument that's unimportant. Also,
but we have the fact that they didn't appeal it.
NMB and
they appealed this one.
That's
and
right.
So even on a clean slate with nothing else, we'd assume that parties behave in their interest and that therefore they had a big interest in spending the money for an appeal on this patent and not on the other one.
Your Honor, first of all, the exception that they're trying to use is very narrowly tailored. If you look at the cases they've cited, they are situations where the party essentially had no interest. Here, they filed a motion to reconsider. They went all the way through arguing it at every stage of the IPR. This is clearly not a situation with no interest.
You're saying in order for us to exercise our equitable discretion, we need to see whether we think that it's correct when they say it wasn't important.
I think you need to look and see if they have any evidence of that. And if there's evidence that it was important, and weigh that. And the one other
evidence is that they didn't appeal it. And one assumes that issues that are important are being appealed. We assume that parties are acting in their self-interest and they are doing things appropriately. So we would otherwise be, and we know they didn't appeal those. So otherwise we are telling them that you have to appeal issues that you've decided you don't want to appeal, simply to preserve the right to ever adjudicate this question in this context.
And, Your Honor, that's exactly what happened in B&B Hardware. In B&B Hardware, the party had not appealed the decision of the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, and the Supreme Court found that that caused issue preclusion, even though, as you just pointed out, they chose not to appeal, which might suggest they didn't care that much about it, but the Supreme Court still found issue preclusion. And, you know, B&B Hardware has been the law for several years now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. I don't want to take all of your time, but could you just spend the first 30 seconds or so telling me why my reading of the statute is wrong, why it wouldn't be just the board cannot institute if at the time of filing the party was under 18 years old? Why isn't that kind of a parallel circumstance to what we've got here?
I think it is parallel as far as it goes. If the statute specifically said, and I think this is your hypothetical, the only time you look to determine and the only evidence you consider to determine the condition precedent is at a specific point in time, I agree with your hypothetical. But that's not this statute. 315B doesn't say what evidence the board can consider in deciding when and whether somebody is a privity or is a barred party. That's why we're here, because the statute actually doesn't say that. It doesn't say you can't look up until the time that you actually institute. And in fact, it strongly implies the opposite, right? Because it says that the board cannot institute unless. So I think that's the answer. Your analogy is close, but not exact to what the statute actually says. You asked one other question, Chief Judge Prost, that I don't think I gave you a specific cite for, and I'd like to now, and that was these non-precedential board opinions, Aris, and I'm blanking on the other one. Why you don't defer to those? I think you want to look at Aqua Products. Synopsis, excuse me, is the other one. Aqua Products, 872 F3rd at 1320. And the principle is that unless the agency's prior decisions are the result of a formal process and a formal rulemaking, they do not get deference. And these decisions don't.
Or it leaves open the question about precedential board opinions, does it not?
Well, maybe, but these are not, right? I mean, these aren't even precedential board opinions. And this sort of goes, I think, to Judge Stahl's observation that, gee, isn't what's happening here that the board in this case did this analysis and reached this result without the guidance from this court that you've now provided in all these later cases? And the answer to that is yes.
Okay. Can you distinguish B&B Hardware from this case?
Right. So B&B Hardware is a case, it was a forum shopping case, right, where a party had lost in one forum and tried it again in another. In that case, it was TTAB versus district court. So again, it actually goes back to my comment about Max Linear. It was not a case where issue preclusion was argued that it should be applied to prevent review entirely. The party had an opportunity to litigate the issue. They litigated the issue. They got an answer on the merits on the issue, didn't like it, and tried to get a do-over. That's not at all what's going on here.
Did B&B Harbor involve parallel decisions like we have here?
Not like we have here. Parallel only in the sense that it was a trademark issue and the party had lost on the specific trademark issue in front of the board, the trademark board, and then came to district court and tried to litigate the same issue in district court and say, I'm not precluded by what happened over there. So it really, I mean, factually it's not apposite, but the principle is really very, very different because, again, ON wants you to apply issue preclusion here to prevent entirely your review of this issue.
Can I ask you just to make sure I'm clear on something? There were 9 IPRs and you appealed 8 of them. Did I hear you say that?
There actually were 12 filed after the merger, all addressing patents Fairchild had either been found to infringe or was accused of infringing. Okay. The board instituted on 9 and not on 3. Mm-hmm. And 8 of those are on appeal. And so the one decision, so 8 of them, you have 8 cases pending in front of you.
They would want you to have appealed all 9.
That's their argument. Okay. 8 out of 9, sorry, you're out of luck, essentially. Yes.
For any of the 9.
Across the board, even though.
But why not? If you appealed it in the other cases and so many other cases, why not this case?
Well, you know, in retrospect, we're sitting here thinking, gee, I guess we should have. The why not is because it wasn't important enough in that case to keep that appeal alive against the backdrop of 9, well, in that I should say 8 other IPRs, especially, Judge, where this case was first, right? This is the bellwether case. The issue of privity came up in this case. We pursued it vigorously, as you see from this record, and we appealed it first in this case. And so really their argument comes down to you didn't serially pursue the same issue 8 other times and therefore you can't pursue it this time. And I don't think you're going to find a case that says that, including the ones they cite. I really don't think you are.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The argument has been very helpful. Case is submitted.